The Center for Biblical and Theological Education presents Lectio Guided Bible Reading. All guided Bible readings are the property of Seattle Pacific University. For copyright information or to learn more about the Center for Biblical and Theological Education, please visit www.spu.edu/CBTE. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world through the power of God's Word.
Emmanuel Revisited, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1 through chapter 12, verse 6. For the time comes of the dominion of men, and the elder kindred shall fade or depart. The burden must lie now upon you and your kindred. Thus the stage is set for the drama in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. The fate of Middle-earth will rest in the race of men. Even though the noble warrior Aragorn objects to this responsibility bestowed upon him, since he is but a mortal, perhaps one should turn to the elves instead, since they possess immortality. But it will be humans, with all their valor as well as vices, upon whom the destiny of Middle-earth rests. As we have observed in previous lessons, in Jerusalem and its inhabitants lies a fate of the cosmos in the book of Isaiah. It is Jerusalem that functions as a nexus between heaven and earth. Like humans in the Lord of the Rings, Israel at times marvelously succeeds and on other occasions fails miserably. As Isaiah 2 has indicated, the time comes of the dominion of Israel. So it is no surprise that in Isaiah all eyes are on Jerusalem. Once again, it is the word of the Lord that performs the will of Yahweh. Earlier, we have seen that it is the word of the Lord that speaks judgment on Israel. It also announces visions of hope. In chapter 9, verse 8, we observe the divine word in action again, and in this case, it condemns Israel as well as the Assyrians, yet offers the hope for a remnant. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 8 through 21 is a word of judgment against Israel, not Judah. The mention of Israel, Ephraim, Samaria, and Manasseh indicates that here we are talking specifically about the northern kingdom Israel. Even though Isaiah prophesies solely in the southern kingdom Judah, and his prophecy is focused on Jerusalem, he speaks at length about Judah's sister kingdom Israel. Later, the prophet Jeremiah will remind the Judeans that they are to learn from observing the unfaithfulness of Israel and not follow in her destructive ways. Earlier, Isaiah chapter 2, verses 6 through 22, described how Yahweh is fundamentally at odds with the proud and lofty. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 9 and 10, describes how, out of its pride and arrogance, Israel believed it could patch up its brokenness with more expensive materials of dress stones and cedar. But Yahweh reminds Israel that his hand is stretched out still. This phrase first appeared in chapter 5, verse 25, and occurs in chapter 9, verse 11, 16, 20, and chapter 10, verse 4. In chapters 10 and 11, it will be the hand of the Lord that acts in judgment as well as salvation. This image portrays Yahweh as conquering warrior and emphasizes the systematic judgment Yahweh effects against his sinful people. In chapter 9, verses 13 through 17, the greatest among them, the prophet, the elder, and the dignitary, Israel's leadership, are indicted for their sins, as well as the least among them, the young, the orphan, and the widow. Yahweh extends his outstretched hand of judgment on every Israelite because everyone was godless and an evildoer. But Jerusalem and Judah must take heed of Israel's example because they are not exempt from Yahweh's judgment. In chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, Isaiah addresses the people of Jerusalem and Judah, announcing that the day of the Lord is coming upon them, and that the same arm that is stretched out in judgment over Israel also judges them. The difficult news for Israel to swallow is that the instrument in Yahweh's outstretched hand is none other than Israel's enemy Assyria. Isaiah announces that Assyria is the rod, or the club, by which God will unleash his anger on the godless nation Israel. The phrases in chapter 10, verse 6, to take spoil, lishlol shalal, and seize plunder, lavoz baz, recall both the sign of maher shalal hashbaz, the spoil speeds and the plunder hastens, in Isaiah chapter 8, verses 3 and 4. And Isaiah's earlier announcement that Assyria would invade Israel, Syria, and eventually Judah. Yet Assyria is not content to be an instrument in God's hand, and begins to boast that it is by the strength of its own hands that it rules the earth. The cities mentioned in chapter 10, verse 8 and 9, correspond to Assyrian expansion in the late 8th century BCE. Calno fell to Tiglath-Pileser III in 738, and Carchemish to Sargon II in 717, and to Hamath in 720. Arpad was destroyed in both 738 and 720. When the king of Assyria begins to boast and exalt himself, actions that we have already seen that are completely at odds with the Holy One of Israel, God decides to judge Assyria as well. The language used in chapter 10, verses 12 through 19, foreshadows chapters 36 through 38, which narrate the invasion of Jerusalem by Sennacherib, Rabshakeh's blasphemous boasts against Yahweh, and God's deliverance of Zion. Assyria oversteps its role as God's instrument by opposing Jerusalem, the elect city of God. Isaiah employs the image of deforestation throughout to illustrate his judgment on Israel and the nations. In this case, creation is both harmed in judgment and redeemed in God's salvation of Israel and the nations. As mentioned previously, Isaiah's vision is cosmic in scope. Therefore, there are ecological ramifications to Israel's vocation as God's people and God's dealings with them. While Israel may rely on increased cedar lumber to bolster its defenses, God is a mighty lumberjack. Isaiah chapter 10, verses 33 and 34 read, "Look, the sovereign, the Lord of hosts, will lop the boughs with terrifying power. The tallest trees will be cut down, and the lofty will be brought low. He will hack down the thickets of the forest with an axe, and Lebanon with its majestic trees will fall." More devastating than the logging, the deforestation will take place through a raging forest fire. During the dry summer months in the land of Israel, great brush and forest fires are a serious threat. In chapter 9, verse 18, Israel's wickedness is depicted as a fire. In the very next verse, it is the Lord's wrath that is a fire that burns both land and people. But as the saying goes, if you play with fire, you're gonna get burned. Assyria too will go up in smoke when it attempts to exalt itself over the Holy One of Israel. The hubris of Assyria, illustrated most poignantly in its military conquests, wreaked destruction not only upon people, but also upon the land. The Assyrians would plunder not only a foreign nation's human resources, but their natural resources as well. Sargon II speaks of razing, destroying, and burning cities in his conquests. Assyria sinned through defacing not only humanity, but also creation, and so they will meet the same fate. One here thinks of Tolkien's Middle Earth, where deforestation represents the loss of people and land. In his unfinished tales, it is a Numenorean's lust for timber to supply their shipyards and Sauron's war preparations that led to the devastation of the forests. Like Isaiah, Tolkien imagines a world of trees that have become far and wide on either bank of the river, a desert, treeless but untilled. God judges Assyria not only for its crimes against humanity, but also for its crimes against creation. The book of Isaiah chronicles the story of Israel from its beginning as a lush forest and vineyard to its demise as a desolate wilderness overgrown with briars and thorns. Thankfully, Isaiah is ultimately not a tragedy, since the latter half of the book will narrate how Yahweh transforms the wasteland of Israel back into a lush garden. It is no wonder that Isaiah's prophecy of a coming king in Isaiah chapter 9 verses 1 through 7 and chapter 11 verses 1 through 9 involves a transformation of the land as well as a restoration of creation. While the vision is not focused on reforestation per se, the theme of trees continues to be present in the announcement that a shoot shall come out of the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of its roots. And on that day, the root of Jesse shall stand as a signal to the peoples. Earlier in chapters 7 and 8, the sign of Emmanuel, the birth of a child, possessed a double edge, as it signified both salvation and God's judgment upon Israel. Whether the child was the prophet's or Ahaz's, it appears that a child was born to that generation, and God both delivered Jerusalem from the Syro-Ephraimite coalition and later allowed Assyria to conquer Judah and encroach upon Jerusalem. Yet, the Emmanuel prophecy was not exhausted in these events. The vision of Isaiah extends beyond the time of the 8th century prophet. In chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, Isaiah prophesies of another child and son to be born on behalf of God's people. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1 picks up on the theme of gloom and darkness in chapter 8, verse 22. The story in chapters 6 through 8 ends on an ominous note. They will look to the earth, but only see distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. The geographical territories mentioned in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, correspond to the sections of Israel annexed by Tiglath-Pileser III, beginning in 732 BCE. So this darkness appears associated with Assyrian domination. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2 acknowledges this period of darkness, but also announces its end. This righteous ruler possesses the executive authority and capability to liberate Israel from foreign oppressors and establish justice and righteousness eternally. This is a messianic figure in the manner of 2 Samuel 7 and Psalm chapter 2. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace are royal designations. He is the ultimate leader who not only possesses the best plan, but can execute it. In addition to the language of child and son in chapter 9, verse 6, the announcement that this individual is for us, Lanu, indicates that this figure is Emmanuel, God with us. Earlier, Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13 provided hope that even though God may cut down Israel, he would leave the holy seed as a stump to potentially sprout again and bring about new life. In Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1, it is a holy stump and roots of Jesse that will give rise to a messianic shoot or branch. The mention of Jesse recalls David's humble origins as a shepherd, the youngest of his brothers, from the town of Bethlehem, who would go on to rule over all of Israel. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, announces that the Davidic Messiah will come and bring a kingdom of peace to the entire cosmos. The famous American Quaker artist Edward Hicks drew his inspiration for his Peaceable Kingdom paintings from Isaiah chapter 11, verses 6 through 9. What is fascinating is that Hicks imagines peace to be one of social, political, and ecological harmony. He depicts treaties between colonists and Native Americans, and images of wild animals living in harmony with children, in stark contrast to his other works illustrating the destructive forces of industrialization. Isaiah chapter 65, verse 25, a text describing the new heavens and earth, also repeats the phrase, "They shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain," and similarly describes the domestication of dangerous beasts of the field. The Messiah rules not only over human kingdoms, but over all creation, and his reign is not only on earth, but also in heaven. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 10 through chapter 12, verse 6, provides a fitting conclusion to chapters 1 through 12. Isaiah provides several glimpses of Israel's glorious future throughout these chapters, culminating in the prophecy of chapter 11, verses 1 through 16. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, speaks of the exaltation of Zion over the nations, and chapter 4, verses 2 through 6, describes the purification of Jerusalem. The focus in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 through 7 and 11, verses 1 through 9 is on the Messiah and his sovereignty over all the nations and creation. In chapter 11, verses 11 through 16, we read once again of the ingathering of the nations, presumably to Jerusalem, in a manner reminiscent of chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Zion, or Jerusalem, is not explicitly mentioned as a destination of the pilgrimage in these verses. But the reader naturally recalls the intertext of chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, given chapters 1 through 12 form a unit, and chapter 12, verses 1 through 6 explicitly celebrates the exaltation of Zion. Thus, Isaiah chapters 1 through 12 provides a following hope for Israel. In the future, God will gather his dispersed remnant from among the nations in the manner of a new exodus, to dwell in a purified and glorified Jerusalem. The Messiah will rule from this place, destroy all evildoers, and bring harmony to all of creation. The nations will come peaceably in submission to Yahweh's rule and instruction, and Zion will once more be the city of righteousness and faithfulness. While certainly Israel will undergo judgment at the hands of the Assyrians, Israel will not be completely rejected. A remnant will survive, not merely by sheer luck or tenacity, but rather by faith. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 20 indicates that this remnant is characterized by its no longer leaning on Assyrian power, but instead leaning on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel in truth. Isaiah is no universalist, believing in the salvation of all peoples regardless of their allegiances. It is only the fraction of the people of Israel who survive God's judgment by faith who are allowed to return. The word remnant recalls the possibility of a tenth part remaining in chapter 6, verse 13, and in chapter 7, verse 3, Isaiah's son Shear Yashuv means a remnant shall return. In chapter 11, verse 11, this remnant returns not only from Assyria, but also from Israel's other conventional enemies, Egypt, Babylon, Persia, and Damascus, as well as from the farthest corners of the earth, as indicated by the mention of the coastlands of the sea. The hostility between the northern and southern kingdoms, which factored into the events of chapters 7 and 8, will be no more, and Israel will subdue their regional rivals. This great ingathering will come in the form of a new exodus, reminiscent of the first exodus out of Egypt. Yet in this case, the people will flee from Assyria as well. In chapter 11, verse 10, the announcement of the Messiah is combined with the salvation announcement of a great homecoming. This new exodus will not be led by Moses, but rather by the Messiah. The Messiah will be raised up as a signal for this ingathering. Chapter 12 ends the salvation message of chapters 1 through 11 with a hymn of praise for God's deliverance. Throughout Scripture, a thanksgiving psalm follows an act of redemption. For example, Exodus 15, the great Song of the Sea, is sung in celebration of Yahweh's victory over Pharaoh in Exodus 14. Isaiah is no exception. Thus, chapter 12 is a proper response to the mighty acts of God described in chapters 1 through 11. The psalm is one that will be sung by the remnant and the nations in that day when this prophecy is fulfilled. Yet in the present, the people of God can sing this song as a means of comfort that provides them the hope to endure God's judgment in the present.